Chapter 13. People in German as well as in their local dialect, and, as far as a passing observer could discern, it seemed as though everything had been done to reduce to a minimum the sense of strangeness and friction which is inevitable in the transition from one rule to another. The interesting point was that this exercise of tact and tolerance seemed to proceed, not from any pressure of expediency, but from a sympathetic understanding of the point of view of this people of the border. I heard in Dana Mary not a syllable of lyrical patriotism or postcard sentimentality, but only a kindly and impartial estimate of facts as they were and must be dealt with. August 18th. Today again we started early for the mountains. Our road ran more to the westward, through the heart of the Vosges, and up to a fold of the hills near the borders of Lorraine. We stopped at a headquarters, where a young officer of dragoons was to join us, and learned from him that we were to be allowed to visit some of the first line trenches which we had looked out on from a high perched observation post on our former visit to the Vosges. Violent fighting was going on in that particular region, and after a climb of an hour or two we had to leave the motor at a sheltered angle of the road and strike across the hills on foot. Our path lay through the forest, and every now and then we caught a glimpse of the high road running below us in full view of the German batteries. Presently we reached a point where the road was screened by a thick growth of trees behind which an observation post had been set up. We scrambled down and looked through the peephole. Just below us lay a valley with a village in its center, and to the left and right of the village were two hills, the one scored with French, the other with German trenches. The village, at first sight, looked as normal as those through which we had been passing, but a closer inspection showed that its steeple was shattered, and that some of its houses were unroofed. Part of it was held by German, part by French troops. The cemetery adjoining the church, and a quarry just under it, belonged to the Germans, but a line of French trenches ran from the farther side of the church up to the French batteries on the right-hand hill. Parallel with this line, but starting from the other side of the village, was a hollow lane leading up to a single tree. This lane was a German trench, protected by the guns of the left-hand hill, and between the two lay perhaps 50 yards of ground. All this was close under us, and closer still was a slope of open ground leading up to the village, and traversed by a rough cart track. Along this track in the hot sunshine little French soldiers, the size of tin toys, were scrambling up with bags and loads of faggots, their ant-like activity as orderly and untroubled as if the two armies had not lain trench to trench a few yards away. It was one of those strange and contradictory scenes of war that bring home to the bewildered looker on the utter impossibility of picturing how the thing really happens. While we stood watching, we heard the sudden scream of a battery close above us. The crest of the hill we were climbing was alive with 25s, and the piercing noise seemed to burst out at our very backs. It was the most terrible war shriek I had heard. A kind of wolfish baying that called up an image of all the dogs of war simultaneously tugging at their leashes. There is a dreadful majesty in the sound of a distant cannonade. But these yelps and hisses roused only thoughts of horror. And there, on the opposite slope, the black and brown geysers were beginning to spout up from the German trenches, and from the batteries above them came the puff and roar of retaliation. Below us, along the cart track, the little French soldiers continued to scramble up peacefully to the dilapidated village, and presently a group of officers of dragoons, emerging from the wood, came down to welcome us to their headquarters. We continued to climb through the forest, the cannonade still whistling overhead, till we reached the most elaborate trapper colony we had yet seen. Half underground, walled with logs, and deeply roofed by sods tufted with ferns and moss, the cabins were scattered under the trees, and connected with each other by paths beordered with white stones. Before the colonel's cabin the soldiers had made a banked-up flower bed sown with annuals, and farther up the slope, stood a log chapel, a mere gable with a wooden altar under it, all tapestried with ivy and holly. Nearby was the chaplain's subterranean dwelling. It was reached by a deep cutting with ivy-covered sides, and ivy and fir boughs masked the front. The sylvan retreat had just been completed, and the officers, the chaplain, and the soldiers loitering nearby were all equally eager to have it seen and hear it praised. The commanding officer, having done the honors of the camp, led us about a quarter of a mile down the hillside to an open cutting which marked the beginning of the trenches. From the cutting we passed into a long tortuous burrow walled and roofed with carefully fitted logs. The earth floor was covered by a sort of wooden lattice. The only light entering this tunnel was a faint ray from an occasional narrow slit screened by branches, and beside each of these peepholes hung a shield-shaped metal shutter to be pushed over it in case of emergency. The passage wound down the hill, almost doubling on itself, in order to give a view of all the surrounding lines. Presently the roof became much higher, and we saw on one side a curtained niche about 5 feet above the floor. One of the officers pulled the curtain back, and there, on a narrow shelf, a gun between his knees, sat a dragoon, his eyes on a peephole. The curtain was hastily drawn again behind his motionless figure, lest the faint light at his back should betray him. We passed by several of these helmeted watchers, and now and then we came to a deeper recess in which a Matreluse squatted, its black nose thrust through a net of branches. Sometimes the roof of the tunnel was so low that we had to bend nearly double, and at intervals we came to heavy doors, made of logs and sheeted with iron, which shut off one section from another. It is hard to guess the distance one covers in creeping through an unlit passage with different levels and countless turnings, but we must have descended the hillside for at least a mile before we came out into a half-ruined farmhouse. This building, which had kept nothing but its outer walls, and one or two partitions between the rooms, had been transformed into an observation post. In each of its corners a ladder led up to a little shelf on the level of what was once the second story, and on the shelf sat a dragoon at his peephole. Below, in the dilapidated rooms, the usual life of a camp was going on. Some of the soldiers were playing cards at a kitchen table, others mending their clothes, or writing letters or chuckling together not too loud over a comic newspaper. It might have been a scene anywhere along the second line trenches, but for the lowered voices, the suddenness with which I was drawn back from a slit in the wall through which I had incautiously peered, and the presence of these helmeted watchers overhead. We plunged underground again, and began to descend through another darker and narrower tunnel. In the upper one there had been one, or two roofless stretches, where one could straighten one's back and breathe. But here we were in pitch blackness, and saved from breaking our necks only by the gleam of the pocket light which the young lieutenant who led the party shed on our path. As he whisked it up and down to warn us of sudden steps or sharp corners, he remarked that at night even this faint glimmer was forbidden, and that it was a bad job going back and forth from the last outpost till one had learned the turnings. The last outpost was a half-ruined farmhouse like the other. A telephone connected it with headquarters, and more dumb dragoons sat motionless on their lofty shelves. The house was shut off from the tunnel by an armored door, and the orders were that in case of attack, that door should be barred from within, and the access to the tunnel defended to the death by the men in the outpost. We were on the extreme verge of the defenses, on a slope just above the village over which we had heard the artillery roaring a few hours earlier. The spot where we stood was raked on all sides by the enemy's lines, and the nearest trenches were only a few yards away. But of all this nothing was really perceptible or comprehensible to me. As far as my own observation went, we might have been 100 miles from the valley we had looked down on, where the French soldiers were walking peacefully up the cart track in the sunshine. I only knew that we had come out of a black labyrinth into a gutted house among fruit trees, where soldiers were lounging and smoking, and people whispered as they do about a deathbed. Over a break in the walls I saw another gutted farmhouse close by in another orchard. It was an enemy outpost, and silent watchers in helmets of another shape sat there watching on the same high shelves. But all this was infinitely less real and terrible than the cannonade above the disputed village. The artillery had ceased and the air was full of summer murmurs. Close by on a sheltered ledge I saw a patch of vineyard with dewy cobwebs hanging to the vines. I could not understand where we were, or what it was all about, or why a shell from the enemy outpost did not suddenly annihilate us. And then, little by little, there came over me the sense of that mute reciprocal watching from trench to trench. The interlocked stare of innumerable pairs of eyes, stretching on, mile after mile, along the whole sleepless line from Dunkirk to Belfort. My last vision of the French front which I had traveled from end to end, was this picture of a shelled house where a few men, who sat smoking and playing cards in the sunshine, had orders to hold out to the death, rather than let their fraction of that front be broken. The tone of France? Nobody now asks the question that so often, at the beginning of the war, came to me from the other side of the world. What is France like? Everyone knows what France has proved to be like. From being a difficult problem, she has long since become a luminous instance. Nevertheless, to those on whom that illumination has shone only from far off, there may still be something to learn about its component elements, for it has come to consist of many separate rays, and the weary strain of the last year has been the spectroscope to decompose them. From the very beginning, when one felt the effulgence as the mere pale brightness before dawn, the attempt to define it was irresistible. There is a tone, the tingling sense of it was in the air from the first days, the first hours, but, what does it consist in? And just how is one aware of it? In those days the answer was comparatively easy. The tone of France after the declaration of war was the white glow of dedication. A great nation's collective impulse, since there is no English equivalent for that winged word, élan, to resist destruction. But at that time no one knew what the resistance was to cost, how long it would have to last, what sacrifices, material and moral, it would necessitate. And for the moment baser sentiments were silenced. Greed, self-interest, pusillanimity seemed to have been purged from the race. The great sitting of the chamber, that almost religious celebration of defensive union, really expressed the opinion of the whole people. It is fairly easy to soar to the Emperor when one is carried on the wings of such an impulse, and when one does not know how long one is to be kept suspended at the breathing limit. But there is a term to the flight of the most soaring élan. It is likely, after a while, to come back broken-winged, and resign itself to barnyard bounds. National judgments cannot remain for long above individual feelings. And you cannot get a national one out of anything less than a whole nation. The really interesting thing, therefore, was to see, as the war went on, and grew into a calamity unheard of in human annals, how the French spirit would meet it, and what virtues extract from it. The war has been a calamity unheard of, but France has never been afraid of the unheard of. No race has ever, yet so audaciously dispensed with old precedents, as none has ever so revered their relics. It is a great strength, to be able to walk without the support of analogies, and France has always shown that strength in times of crisis. The absorbing question, as the war went on, was to discover how far down into the people this intellectual audacity penetrated, how instinctive it had become, and how it would endure the strain of prolonged inaction. There was never much doubt about the army. When a warlike race has an invader on its soil, the men holding back the invader can never be said to be inactive. But behind the army were the waiting millions to whom that long motionless line in the trenches might gradually have become a mere condition of thought, an accepted limitation to all sorts of activities and pleasures. The danger was that such a war, static, dogged, uneventful, might gradually cramp instead of enlarging the mood of the lookers-on. conscription, of course, was there to minimize this danger. Everyone was sharing alike in the glory and the woe. But the glory was not of a kind to penetrate or dazzle. It requires more imagination to see the halo around tenacity than around dash, and the French still cling to the view that they are, so to speak, the patentees and proprietors of dash, and much less at home with his dull drudge of a partner. So there was reason to fear, in the long run, a gradual but irresistible disintegration, not of public opinion, but of something subtler and more fundamental. Public sentiment. It was possible that civilian France, while collectively seeming to remain at the same height, might individually deteriorate and diminish in its attitude toward the war. The French would not be human, and therefore would not be interesting, if one had not perceived in them occasional symptoms of such a peril. There has not been a Frenchman, or a Frenchwoman save a few harmless, and perhaps nervous theorizers who has wavered about the military policy of the country, but there have naturally been some who have found it less easy than they could have foreseen to live up to the sacrifices it has necessitated. Of course there have been such people. One would have had to postulate them, if they had not come within one's experience. There have been some to whom it was harder than they imagined to give up a certain way of living, or a certain kind of breakfast roll, though the French, being fundamentally temperate, are far less the slaves of the luxuries they have invented, than are the other races who have adopted these luxuries. There have been many more who found the sacrifice of personal happiness of all that made life livable, or one's country worth fighting for, infinitely harder than the most apprehensive imagination could have pictured. There have been mothers and widows for whom a single grave, or the appearance of one name on the missing list, has turned the whole conflict into an idiot's tale. There have been many such. But there have apparently not been enough to deflect by a hair's breadth the subtle current of public sentiment, unless it is truer, as it is infinitely more inspiring, to suppose that, of this company of blinded, baffled sufferers, almost all have had the strength to hide their despair, and to say of the great national effort which has lost most of its meaning to them, though it slay me, yet will I trust in it. That is probably the finest triumph of the tone of France. That its myriad fiery currents flow from, so many hearts made insensible by suffering, that so many dead hands feed its undying lamp. This does not in the least imply that resignation is the prevailing note in the tone of France. The attitude of the French people, after 14 months of trial, is not one of submission to unparalleled calamity. It is one of exultation, energy, the hot resolve to dominate the disaster. In all classes the feeling is the same. Every word and every act is based on the resolute ignoring of any alternative to victory. The French people no more think of a compromise than people would think of facing a flood, or an earthquake with a white flag. Two questions are likely to be put to any observer of the struggle who risks such assertions. What, one may be asked, are the proofs of this national tone? And what conditions and qualities seem to? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.